Welcome to Walk About the Galaxy, the Trans-Pacific Astronomy Podcast, where the science is universal, the opinions are personal, and the vibe is aloha. We are Strange Charm Up and Top, the Astrocorps, also known as Josh Caldwell,
Addie Dove,
Hannah Sargent,
and Jim Cooney,
coming to you from 0.7736 kilometers apart near the Tropic of Cancer. Remember to subscribe to us on all platforms, including YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Follow the Astrocorps on TikTok, where we have one entire video. Our website at walkaboutthegalaxy.com is being upgraded, but you can check out our t-shirts there and contact us anytime at wtg@ucf.edu. Definitely contact us that way if you order a shirt so we can get it to you as soon as possible. Our stumper today is observational astronomical. So we're all very excited about the JWST successful launch and deployment en route to L2. But there are lots and lots of amazing observatories, not just in space, but on the Earth as well. If you could get a month of dedicated time on any observatory, ground-based or space-based, which one would you take and what would you look at? And as a ground-based bonus, if you want, you can go do your observations on site. Addie?
Oh, man. I was hoping to not go first. Because I am not an observational person, so I actually don't know. I feel like I don't have a good grasp on all of the telescopes and their capabilities. But I think I would want to do a ground-based one and go there and take observations, because that's like one of the things that, like, as an astronomer, you like. I sort of did that. Like, so when I spent the summer in Hawaii, where you are, Josh, yeah. We went for a weekend to Mauna Kea, and we got to like be there and see. We got to observe someone else observing.
Right.
So like,
there's a certain sort of romance associated with that whole, you know, spending the night overnight at the observatory on a mountaintop or something.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it's done remotely these days. Like, you can just do it from your office, but that's not as fun. But so like going to maybe like the Canaries or something to do the observations sounds pretty fun.
Yeah. So Grand Canary.
And I mean, I'd probably look at like asteroids or the moon or something, because
okay,
I'm me.
So we're going to say the Canary Islands and asteroids.
Probably like an infrared telescope, maybe.
take some near infrared observations through the Earth's atmosphere. Hannah, what about you?
This question was really hard for me as well for exactly the same reason. I'm not an astronomer, but the only thing I know, I don't know if it counts, but the only telescopes and things that I'm aware of that relate to what I'm interested in are, for example, the Parkes telescope in Australia, and it was used to monitor and track like the Apollo missions when the Earth was spinning and it couldn't be tracked from the US. And I really love that concept. And there's like, for those who haven't seen it, there's a really cool film called The Dish about the role of this telescope in the Apollo missions. And I think they're going to be involved in at least some of the private missions to the moon. I don't know whether it would work with Artemis or not, but it would be cool to kind of monitor the next sort of crewed missions to the moon from a distant exotic land. That could be fun.
Okay, so that's a radio telescope, like, just to clarify, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry?
So we're talking about a radio telescope.
Yeah, that's
just
a radio telescope.
To clarify, yeah. Right, yeah. And what you're going to observe is people.
Yeah, or just the movement of people doing cool things.
Yeah.
You could do, one of us could do Sophia, too, and do water on the moon signature with Sophia.
I thought about that one, but I didn't know if you can fly on Sophia when it's
you
doing
do.
Its thing.
As,
do you?
As part of the stumper, you can, anyway.
No, you can't in real life.
You could go to JWST, but you could fly in Sophia. Yeah. All right, Jim.
Oh, yeah. This one's even harder for me because...
come on, you guys.
Well, they're supposed to be stumpers.
You want them
they
to be
are.
Stumpers, Josh.
Because none of us are really observational astronomers. I'm a theoretical physicist, for God's sakes. I certainly don't know much. But...
Wait a minute.
Since it's
what?
Proposed,
damn it,
I'm going
Jim.
To the South Pole. I'm going to the South Pole Telescope.
Ooh, yeah.
Which nice. Has some really great views. And the South Pole Telescope, there's one that's called the South Pole Telescope, right? It's some kind of big 10-meter thing that looks in like the millimeter type range, which is where the cosmic microwave background lives, or a lot of the cosmic microwave background. And they're doing awesome measurements.
It lives in the South Pole?
Them. And this is so cool. You can see things like polarization of the CMB, which I think is going to hold some keys, some really important keys to the fundamental nature of the universe. And so I've got some things lined up that I'm going to observe there.
Cool. I like that answer. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to go there exciting. Because even though it's not that hospitable, it'd be awesome to say you were at the South frickin' Pole.
And you can see. I have see some friends from grad school who used that telescope and got to go observe. And it was like the pictures and like their descriptions have been amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds cool. That is a long trip. I had a hard enough time just making it to Hawaii. So I think I would probably stick with, I have a long history of observational astronomy from spacecraft, which is very comfortable. You just log on to your computer. There's the data, you know, daytime kind of job. And it was awesome. So I'd probably stick with that. I'd probably go JWST.
Oh, look nice. At
some, yeah, yeah. Well, today it's we'll good. Talk about a mysterious occulting object around a binary star, actual in-situ detection of water on the moon, the sun's local bubble, and some new insights into lightning. But first, this episode of Walk About the Galaxy is brought to you by Rainbows. To liven up your day, try Rainbows. These colorful manifestations of a combination of refraction and reflection inside water droplets in the atmosphere can bring a sense of calm and joy to your hectic daily routine. Reliably at an angular distance of 42 degrees from your line of sight away from the sun and spanning all the colors visible to the human eye and more, Rainbows are available in single and double versions depending on the number of reflections inside the droplet. And for the adventurous, go airborne to get a full circle rainbow. While you won't find a pot of gold at the end of one, or in fact, even find the end of a rainbow at all, given that it is a virtual image, we guarantee you'll find a sense of peace and harmony with the realization that nature is cool. Or your money back. Rainbows, show your colors.
I don't like it.
You don't like it?
You don't like it?
I don't like it because it gives me nightmares. Just because.
What?
When I was in grad, rainbows give me nightmares. In grad school, one of the qualifying questions on my qualifying exams was, it was something about rainbow, like from first principles, from Maxwell's equations, you had to explain everything about a rainbow.
Oh my God.
Oh my gosh.
And so now I have nightmares about rainbows, but they are very pretty.
Whoever that professor is that set you that question that ruined rainbows for you and probably a bunch of other people needs to be punished.
Not cool. Yeah.
That's horrible.
So were you, Josh, inspired?
What's that?
Were you, Josh, inspired by some pretty rainbows that you've seen on your travels to Hawaii?
Well, I've been here just 24 hours or so, and I haven't seen a single rainbow yet, which is very abnormal.
I once saw a halo rainbow, like from above the clouds when I was skydiving in Hawaii.
Oh my gosh. Cool. That's awesome.
It was amazing.
That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the first time I was here, you know, the symbol on the Hawaiian license plate is a rainbow. And the first time I was here, they were just like these brilliant, bright rainbows every time I turned around. I was like, this is can't be real. Come on. Give me a break here. What is this?
Jim's Nightmare Land, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. Am I in Jim's Nightmare? Exactly. Show your colors. Ring any bells?
Kodak?
A hint?
It does.
Oh, that's good. I don't know what. Fujifilm.
Smarties.
Oh, they're so good.
Anyway. Does Skittles have the same slogan here? Taste the rainbow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who does?
That could have been a good one. Skittles. Taste the rainbow.
Oh. Well, we'll come back to, we have a rainbow theme going with our trivia a bit later.
Sorry, Jim.
yeah. It's a nightmarish episode for you. JWST is fully deployed, as I understand, and they're now in a months-long process of focusing.
Yeah. So, like aligning the mirrors and focusing them and stuff.
But I think all of the biggest things have happened and successfully. So this is really great.
Right.
Knock on wood.
And there were so many things that had to happen.
I know it's suspicious, right, Hannah? Things never go this well.
I know, and I just until the first like beautiful, perfect, pristine image comes through, I just hold my breath.
Okay.
Yeah.
We set, as you know, a record for most orbital launches last year, breaking the long-standing record from the 60s. Finally, was broken in 2021, and 2022 is off to a hot start, at least in Florida. We have a bunch of launches going out from the Florida launch range this month, including one today, I believe. Is that right, Annie?
It just got postponed like a minute ago till tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
It's very windy.
Quite windy, yeah.
That's more of our favorite satellite, the Starlink bunch.
Yeah.
40-some. So
there was a recent article about I forget which telescope it's from, but analyzing Starlink observations or Starlink implications on observations. So they do like wide field surveys with that telescope and just like how often Starlink is appearing and some like extrapolation to how much it'll be when it's the full thing. But there is, I just read the abstract, but there is like thing that's like, well, there are lots of tracks and pretty much in every image, but it doesn't actually degrade the quality of the observations for the most part, like, or it minimally degrades the quality of the observations because you can still see the things you're trying to see most of the time.
Right.
And then they do say like other things, like they've talked about doing better sun shielding and stuff like that on the spacecraft to make them less bright too. And that would help.
Yeah. They're full. I mean, if they actually get to the full number, I think they're sort of at about 2,000 or so now. Up there.
There's been but a bunch of failures.
Satellite failures.
Yeah.
As in like the percentage that just aren't fully operational or whatever, and they're having to like deorbit them is like painfully high.
How high is that?
I think either in one launch or I think one like pack was like 20% or something stupid. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's sort of the SpaceX model these days, though, right? Is just like do a lot of things and waste a lot of, like, just try it. I don't know. Feels like Starlink, right?
So they're at about 2,000 of these satellites. Their full filing plan calls for up to 42,000 Starlink satellites in orbit, which would, a few years ago, before Starlinks were launching, the total number of satellites in orbit was just a few thousand. So it's a dramatic increase in the number of things. These are in low Earth orbit, not in geosynchronous orbit. I read that they are, they're operational. They are delivering Wi-Fi to people in various places around the world. They've got at the moment about 150,000 customers, or about 75 customers per satellite. It's one way to look at that. So I think they're going to have to ramp up their sales end of things, but what do I know? Let's start off close to home with our science topics. There's moon news.
There is moon news. So I know we always talk about water on the moon. There's always discovery of water on the moon as if it's, brand new information, but it's just what type of discovery it is. So this is the first time that water has been detected by an in-situ lander or rover or whatever. So all our observations of water so far have come from either sample return or orbital detection. And the Chang'e 5 rover or mission, which landed late 2020, I believe, has done some, I think it's infrared spectroscopy, and detected some water in the top, very top layer of the soil and a particular rock. It's in very small amounts. We're talking a few hundred parts per million, which matches similar measurements that people have made to using these other techniques. And because it's in the surface layer, we think, or it's been suggested, that it's most likely going to be this like solar wind implanted. So you've got the hydrogen coming in as part of the solar wind, and it's interacting with the minerals there to produce this hydroxyl, which is OH, or water, which is H2O. And then there is potential that they've got this, they've measured water on this particular rock as well. And there's potential that this rock could have come from, say, deeper within the moon. Maybe it was like released from like an impact or an ejection from material deeper within the moon, which could have more volatiles, so more water within it. But unconfirmed kind of source of water, but it's there, first time, close up and personal.
So this was measured, we said in situ because it's there. This is the Chinese lander that's near the South Polar region on the far side of the moon. Is that right?
This one is near side, I think, Oceanus Procellarum, however you pronounce that one.
Procellarum.
And it was, I believe, so this was a landing site that was chosen because it was one of the youngest, or potentially one of the youngest areas on the moon, geologically speaking. They've been doing lots of interesting kind of analyses of the material there for that reason. And as part of that, they've got this this water detection as well.
Okay, so this lander is in Mare Procellarum, and it was chosen because it's a whiter shade of pale. That's just for that's just for our listeners over 60. In any event,
either of the other two know what you're talking about.
I know. It's in situ because the lander is there, but you mentioned it's an infrared measurement, so it's still a camera looking at a spectrum of something. Like it wasn't a chemical sniffer or sort of a ion mass spectrometer type of like I've actually got my grubby little fingers on those water molecules.
But those are coming this year, I believe, or in the next few
grubby fingers.
Years. The grubby fingers are coming. I think that's because, especially if we're heading to the polar regions where we're going to have higher concentrations of actual volatiles, not just, I guess, hydroxyl, which is kind of bound up within the minerals. This would be actual volatiles, hopefully, in the poles.
I mean, one of the reasons people, you know, when we're talking about going to the moon or Mars and we get excited about water, it's not so that we can, like, dig up a couple of bucketfuls and take it into our moon kitchen and heat it up and then drink a glass. It's really to actually break the water apart to get oxygen and hydrogen, right?
Yes. Largely. I always find you've got the two different kind of approaches to it. So you've got the exploration side, which is using it as a resource where you can have, split up your hydrogen and your oxygen. So for your rocket propellant or oxygen for life support and such, and then you have like the science side of things, which is what is the water cycle on the moon, because the moon does have a water cycle and we're trying to understand where is this water coming from, the different sources of water, how does it migrate around the moon, which is like interesting in and of itself. So we're not just going to dig up water for fun.
Right, but I mean, part of it is what made me think of that is that you were saying that some of this water may have been produced by implantation of solar wind hydrogen, sort of impacting minerals on the moon that happen to have oxygen in them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we already know that there's oxygen in those minerals, great. There's your oxygen, and hydrogen is a dime a dozen in the universe. So
yes.
It's kind of like, why get excited about it being water when those are put together, when all you're going to do in the end is take them apart anyway? You're just after the oxygen and the hydrogen.
Well, I have an answer. We don't know which one's best. So, melting frozen water in the poles is arguably sort of easier than doing a very intense, like energy intensive chemical reaction to draw oxygen out of minerals. So you can either target a really convenient landing site on the near side of the moon, equator, and do one of these really intense chemical reactions, or you can head to the poles, which is, I guess, more difficult to access, but potentially requires less energy to extract that water. So it's kind of a trade-off between where you want to put your base.
Okay. Sounds cool. We'll keep our eyes on it. Moving a little bit further afield to the sun and its neighborhood. And it sort of, I don't know, I was going to try to make a very complicated connection to isotopes and things in the supernovas that may have triggered the formation of our own solar system forming or whatever, but I won't. I'll just waste time talking about it.
We can see those on the moon because it's a tracer of our history.
There you go. There you go. Right. So there are some new insights though about the sun and its local neighborhood.
Yeah, it's called the local bubble. Which
not to
I
be
like bubbles
with
a lot,
like the so. Local supercluster or anything like that.
No, it's different.
Somewhat smaller.
Somewhat smaller. So this is a bubble in the Milky Way.
Yeah, this is just I read this and it seemed just a really cool thing. I mean, it seems like all of the youngish stars around us were all born or all the result of a supernova event, I don't know, something like 15 million years ago or something like that, where, you know, when a supernova goes off, there's this pressure wave that, you know, flows out into space and that compresses clouds of gas and dust, which can trigger star formation. We probably think that, you know, something like that is likely, the progenitor of our solar system, but that was so far long ago, right, 5 billion years ago, that we don't really have any. You know, all the stars have moved so much since then that we can't really trace that event back. But this 15 million year ago event we can kind of, we can't see the bubble in gas, but we can see that like all of the recent star formation has happened on this kind of shell of stuff that's been going out from this thing. So that's it's kind of cool. And it just so happens the sun currently is near the center of that bubble. So it's like,
so we're passing through. Yeah. We're an interloper. Passing through,
right? I mean, we were not, obviously it wasn't a partner of the sun that went supernova or anything like that. 15 million years, stars can move quite a bit, but we're currently in the kind of in the middle of this bubble, so we can look out there and see all these all this star formation because of a.
Remind us how long it takes the sun to go around the Milky Way once. It's like
takes a quarter of a billion years.
Okay, so we've done what a dozen or more tours of the Milky Way since the sun was born. So yeah. Everything's all lost from that and. At the moment, we're passing through one that is still sort of intact, 15 million years old.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, right, for these bubbles, like, I guess these bubbles have been theorized for a while, right? So we expect to see them. We sort of see bubbles elsewhere, but like, and they can be formed by not just one supernova, but several that sort of go off in the region. So it's not like a spherically symmetric thing. It's sort of a blobby shaped object that has lots of different structure that we can trace, like you said, with I think it was Gaia observations, right? Of like
right,
lots
the
of
European
different...
yeah space telescope. How yeah. big is so it?
It's a few hundred light years across.
Okay, and so and sort of in that there's not a lot, and sort of there's a sort of spherically distributed set of stars that are youngish.
Yep.
Well, it's not spherical; it's aspherical.
Aspherical, a blob. Yeah.
But blobby
kind of
but it's not spherical exactly, but it's not spherical.
It looks very non-spherical to me in the animation in the picture that they show.
Oh really?
So is this like the first bubble that has been like seen, or are these bubble things that we can see across the galaxy?
So I think we certainly see, you know, when supernovas are young, we see this bubble of, you know, the superheated expanded gas expanding out. We see these bubbles, but then, of course, eventually.
Now we're seeing the stars that were produced
now
by
we're seeing
that
the stars
expanding.
That were formed. I don't think that we've seen that very well before. Because to do that, you have to have three-dimensional, you know, placement of all of the stuff. You have to see where they are in three dimensions really well. And that's challenging, it turns out. I mean, it's harder to do that than you'd think. And so that's what the Gaia satellite was all about. It's an astrometry mission, right, where it's just really looking at the positions and velocities of all of the nearby stars. And so I think this is the first time we've seen something like this.
Yeah, it says it was first theorized in 1977, so about 50 years ago. This is the first time we've actually, like, seen it in this sort of, been able to map it out in the resolution and imaging we have here.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as Jim was saying, yes, to get all those really good three-dimensional positions, relative positions of stars, it's easy when they're close by, but like seeing a bubble like this, how big did you say it was? A few hundred light
200
years?
200 parsecs. Across? I'll put it in parsecs because parsecs are more fun.
So less than 1,000 light years across.
Yeah.
The Milky Way is 100,000 light years across. So like seeing one on the other side of the Milky Way, for example, you'd have to have a really good precision of your distance determination to tell a star that's on the near side of a bubble over there from the star that's on the far side.
We don't have anywhere near that.
So,
I mean, we do a pretty good job for stars that are in these few hundred light years, but outside of that, it gets really tough because we're using parallax, and parallax is the thing that is not easy to do if you're far away.
It's based on a baseline that's only a few light minutes across.
Right.
And so minutes compared to hundreds of thousands of years gives you an idea. Yeah. Cool. Well, we're just passing through this bubble, so it won't be too long before we're out of it, right?
Sure. Astronomically speaking.
Tens, hundreds of thousands of years or something like that, maybe.
Yeah.
Before we talk about some other cool stellar stuff, let me drop the trivia on you.
Don't hurt us.
As I mentioned, it's nightmarish or rainbow themed.
Oh, no. I'm going to dress up as a rainbow for Halloween. Just a heads up.
So, Jim, how do you know the colors of the rainbow? What do you use to remember the sequence of the colors of a rainbow?
From first principles, tell us.
Right. Derive it from Maxwell's equations.
Yeah. Roy G. Biv, I guess. Isn't that what everybody learned when they were a kid?
Yeah, Roy G. Biv. which
what does
is
it stand for? No, like the little poem thing.
Red, orange, green.
Oh, no, do you not have a thing for it?
Well, that's no, so Hannah has an advantage. I'm gonna cut you off, Hannah, because you may already know the answer to this trivia because you have a cultural advantage.
Oh,
so
you're gonna cheater.
You're gonna which will be clear when I when I tell you. Well, actually, Hannah, so what is the little poem that you know of?
Richard of York gave battle in vain.
Yes, amazing. So Richard of York gave battle in vain because Roy G. Biv is just like that's just the letters. It's not the actual mnemonic, right? Americans
mnemonic.
The actual mnemonic is Richard of York gave battle in vain. So Hannah, don't blurt out the answer if you know it, since you're from jolly old England. Your trivia question is, who is the person who came up with that mnemonic for the colors in a rainbow? Richard of York gave battle in vain. Your choices are Robert Hooke of Hooke's Law fame, Isaac Newton of Newtonian gravity and corpuscular theory of light fame, Thomas Young of Young's modulus, and this guy, I didn't really know much about Thomas Young, but we've heard of Young's modulus, and he was also the key decoder of the Rosetta Stone.
There's a new book about that I want to read.
And published about the wave theory of light, sort of rebutting Newton's theory of light. So we got Robert Hooke, Isaac Newton, Thomas Young, Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet fame, second royal astronomer, or King George III, long reigning monarch from 1760 to 1820, and the inspiration for the Astrocork's first music video. So those are your choices. One of those individuals, and they're all English, is why Hannah has a cultural advantage here, is the person who originated Richard of York gave battle in vain. And I have to confess, Hannah, I was not aware of that mnemonic either. My whole life, I only knew Roy G. Biv, which just shows how unimaginative Americans are. It sounds like a used car salesman.
Right? I mean, to be fair, Roy G. Biv is the first thing that comes to mind. And then I remember learning it at school, the mnemonic. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Americans would never remember that Richard of York gave battle in vain, but we would remember, come on down to Roy G. Biv's used auto park.
That doesn't even make grammatical sense. You have to, the mnemonic has to at least make grammatical, gave battle in vain?
I don't know anything about the story. I don't know who Richard of York is. All I know is the rainbow. So.
Oh, wow.
Isn't Richard of York is not King Richard III?
I have no idea. It's unlike presidents. Our monarchs go back so many hundreds of years that there's no way I could remember what all of them do.
Oh, excuse me.
Sorry, we have a lot of history that we just cannot remember.
Okay, right. And they're all related to each other.
Yeah, in a really messed up kind of way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll come back to that a little bit later and see what you think. We've talked before many times about these cool observatories and programs that are looking for exoplanets by looking at transits. And one we haven't talked about too much recently is TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, which is in some sense sort of a follow-on to Kepler, but it has a kind of different observing scheme and program. But it's taken a look at a new mysterious object, and I love the title of the paper in the Astronomical Journal by Brian Powell and many co-authors, is Mysterious Dust-Emitting Object Orbiting TIC 400799224. And so this is a TESS looks for periodic dips in a star, which typically, or frequently at least, can be due to a planet passing in between the star and our telescopic line of sight to the star, and measure the period and then look at the nature of the dip. It can be due to a planet. This one is mysterious for a number of reasons. It's blocking between about 37% up to 75% of the light from the star, and it's in a binary star system. The period is about 20 days, but it doesn't happen every 20 days. And it doesn't happen with the same depth But it does happen like clockwork. So it either happens or it doesn't every 20 days, but it never happens at like 18 days or 22 days, right? So it's really got that nice, super precise periodicity that makes us think gravity. You know, something is in orbit and has that nice, you know, metronomic quality of things that are in orbit around something else. That's your next TikTok video, Jim.
That's aliens.
They did not actually, I have to say that the paper did not consider, they considered lots of possibilities for what was producing this dip, and aliens was not among the possibilities. There was something, there was something about a star being blocked by something that we've talked about previously on the show, right, Jim, where they were suggesting maybe it's some alien megastructure or something. In this case, they considered several scenarios. They concluded it's most likely dust, but it's a kind of a lot of dust.
Like dust, you know, in a confined cloud of dust, I guess?
It's confined enough that it comes back that it's this periodic thing. So it's not like filling the orbit and then staying there, because then you would have a much longer duration activity. And they looked at observations over about 6 years. They saw it with TESS, then they went back and looked at some data from other telescopic surveys. They requested new data from other survey telescopes, try to put it all together, did all of this. And you know, it's tricky to pull these periods out of these things, because you look at something, you're not necessarily looking during the dip. You know, we're stuck on the Earth, you got to have your telescope pointed at, you know, able to see the star at the right time, and you've got weather considerations, blah, 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 all these things. So they did lots and lots and lots and lots of very careful analysis to put all this together. And it really is, you know, a very convincing period of this 19.77 day repetition, but not every single time. The most recent survey they did with a ground-based telescope, the three occasions to see it, they saw it in two out of those three.
That's bizarre that you just wouldn't see it at all. I don't understand.
Well,
I did see.
Go ahead.
I remember seeing sort of when they were asking other scientists about what it could be, because the team say that they've managed to rule out most of the reasons, but there are still kind of skeptics suggesting that it could be sunspots that are changing that luminosity periodically. If those sunspots are growing and disappearing and whatnot, which I thought was interesting. But yeah, I don't know enough about how they can tell whether it is a sunspot or not.
I think, you know, that's a really good point, though, because that is something else that produces these periodic brightness changes. It's stuff going on the star itself, and the star spins at a very regular rate. So that also can give you a very beautiful periodic signal like they're seeing here. And, you know, maybe there's something going on inside one of these stars that, you know, like you said, is, you know, blomming up big dark sunspot regions. And if, you know, you look at that region every 20 days, but it's not always such a dramatic event there. One of the things that could have really nailed the case for dust is dust gets warm and then radiates in the infrared. And then you would be able to see telescopically, spectrally, you would be able to see infrared emission from that warm dust. And then that would really seal the deal for it, I think. Unfortunately, at 20-day period, this dust would be at about 1,500 Kelvin. And for various observational reasons with what they're looking at, they don't think they would be able to see that spectral emission from dust in that particular case. They actually do see an emission at a much lower temperature, which would be something further out. But so they considered assuming it's dust, which again, as you pointed out, Hannah, there are other possibilities. Disintegration of some sort of object via sublimation, meaning something you're so close to the star, it's sort of evaporating. Collisions with some sort of asteroid type object that are occurring on a large, so you have like an object that's on a 20-day period close in around the star, and it's getting smacked occasionally And when it gets smacked, it produces a big cloud of dust. And then if that happens, when it's in between us and the star, you see the dip. And if it doesn't get smacked at that time, you don't. And that's what they believe is the most likely scenario. It's actually a pretty significant amount of dust. If it were like a continuous erosion process, then the asteroid Ceres would be gone in 8,000 years. It's that fast sort of mass loss rate. If you take a look at how long that stuff lasts after it becomes dust before it's removed from the system.
Yeah, and if it was continuous, you'd expect it to be more of a, you'd probably expect more of a distribution around the orbit too.
Right. Yeah. So
mysteries.
And there's been a, there's a half a dozen or so of these sort of, with caveats.
Dyson that it's spheres. Not,
yeah. These sort of weird things that we've seen there that, usually we end up with dust as the culprit, just like with lots of things in solar system stuff, we usually sort of end up with collisions as the culprit. Why did that happen? Must have been
this one has both.
Collision. This one is both.
Maybe it's alien warfare going on around the alien collisions.
It could be like in that original series episode, A Taste of Armageddon, which you probably haven't watched yet, Hannah.
You're right. I haven't.
Have you made it to City on the Edge of Forever, at least?
Yes. I don't remember what happens, but it looked pretty.
What?
I was probably vacuuming or something. I have it on in the background.
Oh.
You're going to get fired.
I know. I'm going to get choked off this podcast, aren't I?
you had City on the Edge of Forever on in the background while vacuuming? And just devastated.
Thin ice. Thin ice.
Look pretty. It doesn't look pretty. Anyway, we had some the lightning news.
Yeah, we didn't do any like space news at the beginning. We skipped that segment. We knew at the end.
Well, we talked about rockets launching.
Why don't we save the lightning for next time and make one more mention of one cool thing that both Addie and I were talking about earlier, which was. Okay. Last Saturday, there was a big volcanic eruption on Tonga, which is an island in the Pacific or off that island or something like that. And the videos from that, I mean, it was, you could see from satellite this thing. It was like a nuclear bomb going off in this huge mushroom cloud of stuff and ash and all this kind of, and of course, there were some tsunamis. And even, Josh, you there in Hawaii, I guess they had tsunami warnings. I don't know if anything serious happened in Hawaii, but on the U.S. East Coast and Alaska and things like that as well.
West Coast,
right. The Pacific Coast. But I think a really cool thing, and this is what Addie and they were looking at, is that kind of event. It was such a violent explosion that triggers this awesome pressure wave in the Earth's atmosphere.
Yes.
And
you could see it in some of the satellites.
It's so cool.
Right, on our...
The big one.
Yeah, you could see it in the videos. You could see that pressure wave going out. And actually, on our weather stations, you could see the pressure blip rise. We saw a pressure blip on it. Mm-hmm. We're on like the exact opposite side of the Earth, but of course that pressure wave is going to go wrap around the Earth. I'm sure if you had an even more sensitive thing, you could probably see multiple things as it wrapped around the Earth multiple times. But I thought it was pretty cool. So on our front yard weather station, we could see the pressure wave passing from that volcanic explosion.
So your little home pressure station, your little home weather station in Orlando, Florida, saw the signal from the shockwave produced by this volcanic eruption in the Pacific Ocean. So how long after the eruption did you see that?
So, we had worked it out. It was many hours. It was the right... I mean, I remember that we had, we did some calculations to see, because obviously it does take... I mean, these pressure waves travel at like the speed of sound, which is something like 330 meters per second or something like that. And it's a very long way away, obviously. But we did the right calculations and it was many hours. I mean, like... I can't remember now. Was it 10 or 15 hours or something like that after the event?
It was like 9 time, and I don't remember what time the volcano...
Yeah.
But we worked it out, and it was like at the appropriate time. That's when it should show up, given the speed of sound and how far away it was. So.
Yeah, I saw a cool one from some weather stations in the Keys. That had it in Marathon and Key West or something, maybe. So like far-ish apart. And like you could actually see that they happened at different times. And it was, so they calculated it moving at like 600 mile, I don't know, some obscene speed, right? But it was cool. You could see it localized.
I saw some people were able to detect it in the UK sooner than places, closer to the volcano, because it'd gone sort of like over the pole way. And it was an argument against flat earthers, basically showing that it was able, this shockwave went like over the poles and around to other areas quicker than it did sort of horizontally, which is really cool.
Uh-oh, Jim, you gotta include that in your model.
That's right. Still waiting for that.
Just gonna need more than mirrors. Can you make a TikTok video about your flat earth model, Jim?
Yeah.
The volcano, I've read it described as an undersea volcano. Does that mean the explosion actually occurred below the surface of the sea?
Yeah.
I think the very tip of like the caldera edge was above. Like there were like little bits of island stuff above to begin with, but now there's less. Like some of that got blown off.
Wow. Hopefully our thoughts were the people of Tonga, because the ash fallout was quite hazardous. They've got issues with fresh water. New Zealand and Australia, I believe, are helping out locally. For them. And it was, you know, a very planetary scale event. The satellite images are, you know, shocking. And as you mentioned, Addy, you can see that pressure wave. It reminds me of the great movie Deep Impact, where you can also see the shock wave following the impact.
Were you in the air? Because if you're in a plane, could you have felt that? Or did it be too small?
It's a measurable pressure change, right? But I think like with the scale of what the pilots have to deal with, it's probably not a huge thing. And
I'm not sure how high up it would go either.
That's true. So how high it extends. I mean, the cloud extended up into the mesosphere.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So yeah. Obviously if you're that close. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, very dramatic. And now I want to buy a new weather station.
We have the same one. We can tell you which one we have.
Did you see it as well, Addy, in your weather station?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
We're the ones who told them to look at theirs.
Okay. That's cool. All right. Well, Hannah and I each have to get our own weather stations now. So let's come back to Jim's nightmare. He has not escaped. Who came up with the mnemonic Richard of York gave battle in vain? Was it Robert Hooke, Isaac Newton, Thomas Young, Edmund Halley, or King George III? And we're going to take Hannah last, of course, and we'll put Jim out of his misery first. So
I'll go with Hooke.
Hooke.
I feel like I have a bad sense of time scale for all of these people.
They're all actually at around the same time period. So King George III was king from 17... No, not well. I mean, astronomically speaking. they're sort of 17th and 18th century people.
Okay. Let's go with Halley.
Hannah, what do you say?
I've got no concept, so I'll go for Young.
You're going for Young.
Cover all bases.
Young was my planned distractor, because he did actually, about 100 years after Newton, put out this wave theory of light, which I rebutting Newton's particle theory, but I don't really understand Newton's particle theory, because Newton is the one famously, in our pictures, at least in school books, is seen holding a prism up to a small window in a darkened room and seeing all the colors of the rainbow. And it was in fact Isaac Newton who's came up with this mnemonic, Richard of York gave battle in vain.
Isaac, we all got it wrong. Oh, we stink.
Mm. Yeah. What are the odds? 40% or so. Anyway, while it may have felt like flying from Orlando to Lihue, it was just another episode of Walk About the Galaxy. Give us 5 stars and we'll give you a periodic cloud of dust. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram to get all our updates, and check out our website at walkaboutthegalaxy.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you can see most of our episodes, some of our bloopers, and all of our music videos. Catch up on old episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter.
@walk_the_galaxy.
And ask us questions anywhere using #AskWTG. Our theme music was composed by Richard Jurisic. Thanks to our listeners in Hawaii and around the world. Stay safe, I'm Josh Caldwell.
I'm Addie Dove.
I'm Hannah Sargent.
And I'm Jim Cooney.
We're the Astroport signing off until the next episode of Walk About the Galaxy.
Aloha!